Welcome, gentle listener, to Still Dreaming, a podcast about existentialism and forever night. Forever Night was episodic, but this podcast kind of isn't. You may be best served starting at the beginning with the introduction and working your way forward. So with that, let's begin. So this episode is entitled Cherry Blossoms, and it is primarily set in Toronto's Chinatown. With that, there's some discussion of Chinese culture, language, and the relationship of Chinese immigrant communities to the larger cities they're in. Now, at first, I was afraid this was going to be unintentionally racist or orientalist, and there is some, I'll call it, exotification on display. I didn't see anything that was grossly outrageous, keeping in mind I'm not Asian, so maybe I'm not the best person to comment on it. I will point out whatever I do think is problematic. And I will also say that Cherry Blossoms actually has nothing to do with the story. Now, this may be as good a point as any to give you some personal background that may be of relevance to how I read this particular episode. I've lived in China for about 4 years, and if this COVID-19 thing ever goes away, I may end up going back there. Currently, I'm in the United States. Now, having lived in China in no way makes me an expert on Chinese culture, and it definitely does not give me any insight into Chinese immigrant communities. But where my own personal experiences might lead to some insight, I'll offer what I can. So with that, let's learn about tonight's episode. This episode was directed by Brad Turner and written by Roy Sallows, and it originally aired on August 11th, 1992. The synopsis, taken from Wikipedia, reads as such. Caught in an ambush by Chinese mobsters, Nick discovers that an old man protecting a wounded mobster may be related to an attempt he made to cure his vampirism at an acupuncturist in 1916 Chinatown. When I first watched this, I didn't remember the synopsis, so I didn't know the flashbacks were in San Francisco until the end of the episode when it stated outright. So this tells us that Nick, Jeanette, and LaCroix were in California in 1916. We've gotten clues that Nick was in Chicago more recently, and Nick was in North America during the 17th century, and he had to have been in South America at some point mid-20th century to excavate the Mayan cup we saw in the pilot episode. So all of this just makes me wonder how long Nick has been in the Americas. We know he was in England as recently as the 19th century. Anyway, just curious about the timeline. Oh yeah, and James Hong is in this episode, thus the title, which I hope you'll excuse. I'll try to keep the Jack Burton references to a minimum. I can't help with all the references to China and Chinese culture to go a bit afield from our usual discussion of classic European existentialism to dip our toes into a bit of Taoism this week. Taoist concepts of self and life, not to mention the way, are not really incompatible with existentialism, at least not in my view. And I honestly hope this doesn't come across as being, I don't know, exploitive or orientalist. These are philosophies that I've been at least cursorily studying for the past 4 years, and have had much interest in for a lot longer than that. And this episode provided me an excuse to do a bit of a deeper dive to some of the concepts that are often the center of our discussion in this podcast, such as the nature of the self. I will also be including a discussion on the concept of revenge as described by existentialist writer Simone de Beauvoir, and also from the Taoist tradition. As always, my references are in the show notes. So with that, let's climb aboard the Pork Chop Express and start with the cold open. We open in Chinatown. It's a dark and stormy night. Two men and a woman, speaking Chinese, come out onto the street and they get a taxi in the pouring rain. They're going down an alleyway but get blocked in, and I can only understand a few bits of what's being spoken, including a phrase I use a lot when I'm in China, said by the driver. Shenma? What? They're being ambushed. Bullets flying, the taxi crashes, and a hail of bullets rip through the car. Gangsters in shadow shoot the hell out of that taxi. A man speaking English says, "We're done here," and the gangsters drive off. Opening credits. So, it was actually kind of an interesting opening. Kind of noir, clearly a mob hit, nicely shot. Gives us very little in the way of context or narrative. Leaves a lot of mystery for us. It's appropriate for a cop show, although maybe a bit cliché having an Asian mob and an episode about Chinese culture. So when we come back from the credits, the alleyway is now a crime scene, and cops and our detectives are there. The chief says they have no real lead on the shooters, it's a professional hit, but Nick points out that it's overkill. Three victims, all Chinese. But wait, there were four people in the car. Three passengers and the driver. A man in a suit arrives and introduces himself to the chief. He's Mr. Kwong, and he's with immigration and is given lots of leeway on the scene. The victims weren't legal, and Skanky gets really shitty with Kwong because, of course, he is. Skanky's shitty with everyone he meets the first time. Kwong points out that the police don't have a good relationship with the Chinese community in Toronto. Mr. Kwong says Nancy Lin was supposed to testify against one of Hong Kong's major crime families. Nick points out, though, that all the bodies found in the car were male. So Kwong says Nancy must have gotten away. Okay. How does Kwong know Lin was in the car? We cut to Natalie's lab. She confirms that someone was in the cab that is not one of the victims. The blood type found doesn't match the dead. Now, we find out later two of the dead were Nancy Lin's brother and uncle, so we can surmise that Kwong assumed that Nancy was with them. Nat gets really snippy with Nick in this scene, but she quickly apologizes. Her budget's been cut, and she has to fire a couple of their attendants in the lab, and she's kind of mad about that. Life's a bitch, she says. We're at the station, and Kwong is asking for more effort. Stone Tree says he doesn't have the manpower. Nick suggests bringing in a Chinese detective, since the people of Chinatown don't trust outsiders. Skanky points out that Nick knows how to speak some Chinese, which actually I don't think we've been shown that on the show. In the pilot, I think we hear Nick speaking some Korean, if I remember right. Kwong asks to help with the investigating. Nick points out that there might have been a leak from his immigration department and suggests Kwong look into his own house. And this just makes me wonder more about Mr. Kwong. Is he on the up and up? Is he working for the mob? Did he tip off the gangsters about Lin and is now using his position to try to find her for the mob bosses? The plot thickens. Nick goes to the crime scene and tells the cop on watch to take a coffee break. He touches a dab of blood on the pavement and he vamps out. I guess it was a good thing the cop wasn't there. There's some nice Dutch angles, moody lighting. Again, the cinematographers on the show are top-notch. He goes into a nearby building using his super strength to open a locked door. Flashback time. So we're in San Francisco, 1916, Chinatown, of course. Nick enters a dark den, an acupuncturist studio. A Chinese woman exchanges some dialogue with Nick, in Chinese, and the exposition tells us that she uses acupuncture to help men control their desires for sex, for food, for opium, and so she's going to help Nick control his desire for blood. And you know what? I'm okay with that. I mean, it makes as much sense as Natalie's treatments. Urges and desires are all in the mind, she says. And then she effectively paralyzes Nick with the acupuncture needles. And we're not told why she does that exactly. Then Jeanette dramatically enters, as though Jeanette could enter any other way. We cut back to the present to Nick, who's been caught snooping in the Chinatown acupuncturist shop by the owner, who has pulled a gun on him. Nick shows the man his badge and begins questioning, but the man is very wary, untrusting. Nick shows him a picture of Nancy Lin, and the man hesitates. We get the feeling he knows who Lin is, but he doesn't want to talk to a cop. Nick leaves his card and then exits the shop. The man then has a flashback of his own and reveals to us that he was a young boy working at the acupuncture shop where Nick was getting his treatment. This is in his flashback. Flashback inception. The boy saw Nick feeding on the acupuncturist, who was the boy's mother, and then flies away. Commercial break. Okay, what? So, 1916, Nick was in San Francisco, a city with what, millions of people. He gets treatment for his vampirism by an acupuncturist in Chinatown. Okay, sure, whatever. That makes a weird kind of sense to me. But then Nick kills her, and her son sees the murder, and now, 70 years later, that boy, as an old man, happens to meet Nick as a police detective in Toronto? Holy shit, what a coincidence. So let's pause after that revelation to consider a couple of things. So I wanted to hazard my way into a little bit of Taoism in this episode. One, it isn't existentialism. However, the concepts aren't really that far different from a lot of the ideas of existentialism we've already examined. Two, the old man in this episode, played by James Hong, is working as an acupuncturist, which extends from very old Taoist practices. And at the end of the episode, he produces what he calls a spell, which I'll try to explain later. And I believe that also references Taoist tradition. And three, if we can escape the Eurocentricism of the Western philosophical tradition for a little bit, you know what? All the better. Taoism is said to have begun with the teachings of a semi-mythical teacher named Lao Tzu, who lived and taught in the 6th century BCE. The Tao is usually translated as the way, although any translation from classical Chinese into English is rather problematic. We are helped to think of the Tao, the way, not as a singular unchanging thing, but rather as a process, something that is continuously in flux. The Tao implies the essential and unknowable churning of the universe as process. As such, the Tao can never be completely known. As the Tao Te Ching tells us, that which can be named is not the way. There are two important concepts that I want to focus on tonight as they relate to the issues of the self and our interest in existentialism. In Taoism, we can think of two factors as they relate to identity and self. Zhurong and Wu Wei. And I apologize if my accent is not right. I'm sure it isn't. I'm working with sources that don't use pinyin writing practices, that and I'm bad at Chinese. We can understand Zhurong as itself becoming, which is very different from Western philosophical constructions of the self. The English word self has an egocentric connotation to it that stands in opposition to the other. And this kind of dichotomy is not really present in the notion of Zhurong. More importantly to Taoism is the emphasis on becoming and changing. What we conceive of as self, or as Zhurong, unified with the way, is in continuous flux, in cycles of growth, decay, flourishing, fading, essential to Taoist understandings of the universe. Wu Wei, more or less literally means doing nothing, but most interpreters and historians don't accept this as actual inactivity or passivity. Wu Wei is better understood as effortless action, non-willful action. It is spontaneous, in the flow, in harmony with the Tao. When one's Ziran finds unity with the Tao, Wu Wei is natural, flowing like water, tying the self to the other and all things in unity. And as you might imagine, I am grossly oversimplifying here. But let's get back to the episode for a moment. In Chinatown, Skanky and Kuang are having a conversation about why the locals don't trust cops. Kuang explains that the Chinese in the city feel like outsiders and don't have a trust for authority. Kuang explains that he is also treated with suspicion in Chinatown because he works with Fang Guai, which he explains means barbarians. I'm not familiar with the word Fang Guai. I've heard Guai Lo in Cantonese, but more often than not in mainland China, I live not too far from Shanghai, I've heard myself and other foreigners refer to as Lao Wai, which, while not exactly a polite term, isn't really considered that bad either. Heck, I have a t-shirt with Lao Wai written on it. Skanky, of course, gets all huffy and superior, starts ranting about how Chinese civilization isn't better than European, blah, blah, blah. It's dumb, and the only purpose of the scene is to illuminate precisely what Kuang is saying, that the cops have no respect or interest in the Chinese community, and demonstrates why they feel the way they do. As an arrogant Skanky talks over Kuang and pushes him around, figuratively, on Kuang's own turf. That evening at the station, Kuang and Skanky are in a shouting match, with Kuang accusing Skanky of being, well, a bad dick, which is something I've said over several episodes. So, Kuang Shila. Kuang is mad at Skanky, basically trying to browbeat cooperation out of people, and that seems entirely consistent with what we've seen from Skanky. Kuang says he's going to go over a stone tree's head to complain, and he huffs out. Nick comes into the office at that point. Nick explains about the old Chinese guy at the acupuncturist shop. Skanky wants to go down busting doors because, you know, he's stupid. Stone Tree says he wants Skanky to take Kuang. Stone Tree shuts down Skanky's bullshit. Back in Chinatown, Nick floats above the street to peek in the shop on the old man, and it's kind of creepy. The man goes out on the street. Nick follows. Nick tails him to another building. Meanwhile, Skanky is in a briefing room full of cops and detectives. A break in another case has freed up some manpower. They're going to canvass the neighborhood around the acupuncturist shop, which, as we have established, the residents don't trust the cops, so they're not going to be inclined to cooperate, but I mean, I guess they got to do something. His speech is replete with phrases like, "those people," and instructions to be nice, ask questions, and get the hell out of there. So yeah, your friendly neighborhood cop who doesn't give two fucks about Chinatown. Why don't they like the police? Fucking Skanky. Back in Chinatown, the man is in some kind of warehouse where he's caring for Nancy Lin. It's at this point we learn his name is Dr. Chung. Nick is lurking behind them. Dr. Chung offers some traditional medicine and acupuncture to Nancy, which I'm just going to call bullshit on. While traditional medicine and acupuncture as medical treatment are quite common in China still today, this woman has gunshot wounds and an internal bleeding. Tea ain't going to cut it. You know what China also has? Emergency rooms and surgeons, by the way. Nick walks up to where they are. Nick is cool, keeps Chung from pulling the gun again. He's calm and collected. He keeps the situation from escalating. We take a commercial break, and when we come back, Nick is talking to Nancy. Nick wants to take her to the hospital. Chung orders Nick to sit in a corner. Nancy pleads for his life. Chung tries to calm her. Nancy says immigration ratted her out, and that's why they were hit. Nick and Chung talk. Nick tries to convince him to let Nancy go to a doctor to get surgery. Chong is calm, refusing Nick, and Nick doesn't want to upset them both and get into a skirmish with Chong, so he relents, letting them continue their hideout. We go back to the station. Skanky's at the command center, taking radio reports about the canvas. Nick pops in and said he found Nancy. Nick basically says if they don't tell anyone where Nancy is, then the info can't be leaked. So Nick refuses to tell Stonetree or Skanky. But Nancy's still in critical condition. Quang comes in. He apologizes for his outburst and says the case is important to him. He means immigration. Yeah, Quang's the snitch. Stonetree tells Quang that Nancy is alive, which angers Nick. Quang leaves to make arrangements. Stonetree explains that all he said was that Nancy was found, nothing about her location. He tells Nick to sit on Nancy constantly and take a doctor to treat her. Nick recruits Natalie, who is a doctor, but who's not a surgeon, right? She points out that all her patients are, well, you know, dead, but she does agree to go with him. So Nick drives his caddy to the locale, because that's not a giveaway. They're spotted going into the warehouse, because for real, Nick, your car is a fucking boat. Another car pulls up, and Quang is there. He's handcuffed in the back seat, and he's informing because, yeah, he's the snitch, but he's definitely not there willingly. And Quang, after explaining things to the driver, asks the mobster in the car if they'll now let his family go. So, yeah, that explains that. Inside, Nat is examining Nancy. She's stable but critical, and Natalie is impressed that she's in such good condition. And I'm sorry, but that's still bullshit. You know, I've taken traditional Chinese medicine for colds and injuries. When I lived in China and I would go to the doctor for a cold or flu or minor injury, I would often get some combination of traditional Chinese teas and syrups, along with maybe an antibiotic or fever reducer or some such. But to be totally clear, no sensible Chinese person would think that herbal tea and acupuncture can heal internal bleeding. I think this may be a thing where the writers are trying to be respectful of Chinese culture, but in so doing makes it come across as magical and anachronistic. Traditional Chinese medicine is alive and well in China and Hong Kong and various Chinese diasporas, and it's effective for many things. But I'll say it again. Tea don't fix gunshots. So anyway, Chong waxes poetic about not being able to escape one's past. Keep in mind, at this point, Chong has not revealed his identity to Nick. Nick gets the feeling Chong hates him for some reason, but he doesn't yet know why. So let's pause again. Chong talks about not being able to escape his past. What this episode is warming up to, and it takes a long damn time to get to it, is a revenge plot where Chong decides to take revenge on Nick, whom he believes killed his mother. So I'm going to refer to what the Tao Te Ching has to say about vengeance on this. In chapter 49 of the Tao Te Ching, the master instructs, quote, "To those who are kind, I am kind to them. Those that are unkind, I am also kind to them. Hence kindness is gained. For those that are faithful, I am faithful to them. Those that are unfaithful, I am still faithful to them. Faithfulness is obtained." End quote. Further on, the sage continues, quote, "Make the great small, make the many few. Respond to anger with virtue." End quote. When one lives in accordance with the way, one becomes unified with the way. In Taoism, we are encouraged to transcend egocentrism. Ourself and the society we live in is not conceived of as a rigid hierarchy, but in unity with the way. When we say that anything that has happened to us is good or bad, fortunate or unfortunate, this is just an external judgment. Things happen. They are neither good nor bad. They are all equal. When we accept and act with wu-wei, with non-willful action, with effortless spontaneity, we find the equilibrium with the way and lose distinction between the I and the other. So unified with the way, we find peace. So what does that mean for Chong? That as a boy, he should not feel pain at the murder of his mother? I think that smacks all of us as ridiculous. But I do think it helps us understand a philosophy that encourages self-reflection as a means of coming to terms with pain and grief, a way of learning slowly to deal with loss by understanding that birth, death, love, and loss are cyclical in terms that are reflective of the continuous cycles of the universe, the process of the Tao. But of course, Chong does not do this, nor can we blame him given the trauma of his childhood. The philosophy of the Tao is all fine and well, but how does a boy let go of that kind of despair even as he becomes an old man? So while Taoism traditionally espouses a philosophy that does not have one seeking revenge for even terrible wrongs, promoting instead an ideology of compassion, as mere mortals, we are all subject to feelings of anger and the desire to exact vengeance. So what is the nature of this drive for vengeance? To explore that a bit more, I'm going to return to European existentialism in the form of Simone de Beauvoir's excellent examination of revenge in her remarkable work, The Ethics of Ambiguity, from 1947. De Beauvoir was an atheistic existentialist in the same line as Sartre. As such, she sees existence as always in relation to others. To abuse an other is to erode one's own humanity. By stripping them of their subjectivity, one undermines one's own subjective self. We think of vengeance as a restoration of equilibrium. What was once an excess of power for one becomes my excess of power over them. But really, for de Beauvoir, individual acts of vengeance out of hatefulness only allows one evil to build on the next. As she writes, quote, evil engenders evil, end quote. For her, there's no balance to be had. There's no remedy. There's no way to heal a wound. Chong, through his desired vengeance, cannot compel Nick to suffer, nor compel him to regret. At most, revenge and punishment is not a moral act. It's an act of social control. I think this view of 20th century existentialist writing is not incompatible with what we've been looking at on the surface level with Taoism. Not that de Beauvoir would make that connection. Acts of personal vengeance are not in line with the Tao. They only resist the natural flow of the Tao. Now, psychologically, we can see how the desire for revenge can help us feel empowered where another person made us feel weak. However, committing such acts, plotting such acts, only consumes us with negativity and takes us away from experiencing and living our lives as fully actualized subjectivities. So, when we come back from the commercial break, Nancy is awake and talking to Nick. Mobsters come into the building, like right in the same door Nick and Nat came into, because they didn't even lock it. Ugh. Nick saves Natalie by pushing her out of the way. He vamps out, attacks the mobsters, throwing their guns aside, and they all immediately pull out nunchucks and wooden staffs, and what the fuck? They're gonna kung fu fight a vampire? So this is a facepalm moment. All Chinese people know kung fu and how to fight with wooden staffs. Sure, why not? I mean, especially these young mobster thugs who probably all grew up in Toronto. And Nick is a full-on vampire during the fight. Not one of these gangsters is scared or has any reaction to fighting a monster. So Nick quickly dispatches them in an efficient and anticlimactic manner, But a man who still has a gun is threatening Natalie. Nick goes all Superman-like, taking bullet after bullet to the chest. But Chung comes up behind the mobster and knocks him out with acupuncture foo, I guess. A needle in the neck. You know, whenever I do get back to China, I'm going to have to ask an acupuncturist if that's a real thing. Nick tries to mind-whammy Chung, but it doesn't work. Nat and him exchange panicked looks. Nick has to call in backup. So the crime scene is crawling with cops now, and Nick and Nat talk. Nat is concerned Chung will expose Nick, and she tells Nick to get away if that happens. Nick laments having to go on the run again, says if he does, he'll try to contact her somehow, and she makes him promise he won't give up trying to be human. It's a touching scene, actually. Stonetree talks to Nick. Apparently Chung wants Nick to give him a ride home and said nothing unusual in a statement. So, okay then. Nick talks to Chung after everyone else leaves. Chung plays it cool, saying the only thing he saw was a man trying to save Nancy's life. So Nick is confused, but feels relieved. He turns his back, and then acupuncture foo! Chung stabs him in the neck with a needle, and he knocks him out. When Nick comes to, he's paralyzed with needles, and Chung drops his backstory. By the way, this happens really fast, right at the very end of the episode. Chung says he has a spell to destroy Nick and presents a piece of paper with text written on it. The text in the red ink on the yellow paper indicates to me this is probably a Fulu talisman, which comes from a type of Taoist mysticism. It's an amulet written with coded characters and activated in a ritual to bind or expel certain kinds of ghosts or jiangqi. If you're familiar with the hopping vampires of Hong Kong action movies, then you've probably seen one. Traditional Taoist masters may still know rituals to create such things, depending on their lineage. I mean, this is not exactly a common thing in modern China. I could maybe see someone in Toronto's Chinatown offering such a service. Maybe even Chung has studied the Tao and is a master himself. We're not told how he got the spell. Nick denies killing Chung's mother. Nick spills the rest of the story. Jeanette came in with Lacroix to stop his acupuncture treatments because, well, they're dicks. Lacroix says Nick can't sever their friendship, can never become human. Your desires are immutable, he says. While Nick is still paralyzed, the acupuncturist comes back in and is attacked and killed by Lacroix. Jeanette removes the needle from Nick, but it's too late for him to save the woman. In the present time, Chung demands revenge for his mother's death, pulls out a wooden stake. Nick says, do you remember the woman that was there, Jeanette? Chung does. Nick says, let her speak in my defense. Okay, wait, what? Okay, what the fuck is this? Is this a trial now? Chung is going to allow this creature of the night that he thinks murdered his mother to present witnesses? Really? This is weird, guys. This is really weird. So somehow Jeanette is summoned. I mean, did Chung call the raven? How did that conversation go? She suddenly just comes storming in the twilight, smoking from the faint sun's rays. She's super annoyed at being so inconvenient. She sees Chung holding a stake threatening Nick. She vamps out and threatens to kill Chung. But Nick tells her not to attack. And since when does Jeanette do anything Nick wants? She has in the flashbacks routinely killed Nick, killed people Nick didn't want her to. Jeanette pleads Nick's case, I mean, kind of. She obviously doesn't give a fuck about Chung, and makes it clear she will tear him to shreds if he stabs Nick. But at Nick's prompting, she tells the story. She talks Chung through the memory until he realizes he saw a different man kill his mother, Lacroix. Chung then releases the needles from Nick. So after that, Jeanette nuzzles a bit with Nick, and this is just a weird-ass ending. And poor Chung. He's been harboring this fear and anger for Nick for something like 7 decades, only to find out he was wrong. only to have the object of his pain and hatred snatched away from him. But we don't see any of that. Chung walks off the screen, never to be mentioned again. Okay. So Chung is just going to let Nick walk? Even though Nick is still a vampire? Even if he's not the one who killed his mother? I mean, Chung is really a tragic character in this story. I wish we had a better resolution for him. Or really, any resolution. But it's wrap-up time, and back at the lair, Nick is showing Jeanette around. Jeanette is not impressed with his digs. He explains that if he lives too nicely, people will think he's corrupt. She chides him. You're not human. You never will be. She drinks the blood he has on hand and is repulsed that it's cow's blood. I do have to say I like Jeanette in this. She has some personality. I like her interaction with Nick, and they seem like the writers are fleshing her out a bit more. I dig it. They go back and forth a bit. Jeanette wants Nick to come back to the dark side. Nick is adamant he isn't going to do that. They start making out, and then they're interrupted by Natalie. Awkward. This is Jeanette. We're just old friends, Nick says. Jeanette mentions that Nick has spoken of Natalie quite often to her. So the episode ends on awkward Nick being super awkward, as Jeanette suggests that she and Natalie get together to talk sometime. Yes, I want to hear that conversation. And that's it. That's the end of the episode. So I wanted to make a quick point about Chung's clothing, which looked like a modern version of a Tang Dynasty suit. He's seen wearing it most of the episode. So, I certainly can't speak for how acupuncturists in Toronto's Chinatown like to dress, but my experience in mainland China is that acupuncturists would probably be wearing business casual attire, and certainly wouldn't necessarily be dressed like that. So I'm guessing this is just to make Chung's Chinese-ness more exotic to us. He's the only character who dresses this way, so it may be to emphasize his age as well. Now, I will say it's not uncommon to see people in China dress in a similar fashion for special occasions or to practice Tai Chi or other martial arts or something of that nature. So the jacket he's wearing is not a total anachronism. I've ridden on buses next to men dressed in similar ways. I'm just saying it's not necessary to his profession, and I assume it's in the show to emphasize his Chinese-ness. I thought it was an interesting choice not to subtitle any of the spoken Chinese on the show. Maybe a way of keeping the audience separate. It emphasizes that Chinatown is not assimilated into mainstream Toronto, thus the division with the police. It would have been nice to have more on that, a better exploration of why this community feels separated from the rest of the city. Maybe some scenes with Chinatown residents who are not gangsters or victims being interviewed by the police and giving some glimpses into the Toronto Chinese identity. Overall, this episode is weak. It really doesn't do much to advance Nick on his quest to be human. And if you remember last week, Jeanette told Nick he wasn't one of them and made it sound like she was cutting him off. But then she's all lovey-dovey and coming to his defense. I mean, that doesn't necessarily mean it's a contradiction. It could indicate Jeanette has complex feelings for our hero. Their relationship is difficult to define. They've clearly been lovers, at least intermittently, over the centuries. They were both brought across by Lacroix. At least I think that's the case. I don't think we've been told that directly in the series as of yet. Jeanette clearly cares for Nick, even though we've seen in flashback that she often torments him and even does things she knows will hurt and upset him. Nick seems affectionate towards Jeanette, but it's hard to put a finger on exactly what his feelings for her are. I like the idea of Jeanette and Natalie meeting and getting to know each other. I like at this point in the series that there might be more overlap between Nick's vampire world and his everyday world. James Hong as Dr. Chung is great in the role and gives Chung some humanity in what could have easily been an embarrassingly cliché part for a lesser actor. Now, Hung would have been in his 60s during the time he was playing this part, which is maybe about 20 years younger than the character, if I've done my math right. They age him through the makeup, which is not great, I have to admit, but Hung pulls off a nuanced and tragic character despite it all. I would have liked more time to see Chung descend into his plot for revenge. His heel turn seems really quick at the end of the episode. And as for the acupuncture foo, well, the less said about that, probably the better. I really enjoyed doing the research this week. I didn't do Taoist philosophy any justice, really, but it was fun to dip my toes into it. And we'll definitely be returning to Simone de Beauvoir in the future, to be sure. I actually did a lot of research on Confucianism as well that just didn't fit. So, what's on deck next week? The episode up next is number 9 of season 1, entitled I Will Repay. Ooh, interesting. That comes from a bit of dialogue between Nick and Lacroix from part 2 of the pilot, when Nick says he will repay Lacroix for making him into a vampire. So, how does all that fit in? Tune in next week, gentle listeners. Let's pause for a word from our sponsor. Still Dreaming is a podcast hosted and recorded by me in the newly revamped CERK Internet Radio Studio. Forever Night was produced for CBS by Glenn Warren Productions and Sony Pictures Television. All rights reserved.